You are listening to AWOL Radio here on 102.7 CKMS Radio Waterloo, radiowaterloo.ca, broadcasting to all of Waterloo Region.
Dan Keller in studio with you today. It's the 7th of September, and a beautiful day outside. Hope to enjoy that little bit of Prison Radio. Check out prisonradio.org for more of that. And this is the last week going into Sunday, which was the uprising, the anniversary of the Attica uprising, or the for the prison strike. It's the third week, and there has been action. You see some of the reports from It's Going Down, and you see that some of the prisons have agreed to some of the prisoners' terms. Others have just decided to punish those that are involved in this, in the prison strike. There are people going on hunger strikes, and yeah, it's a large scale resistance from prisoners to the conditions that they're forced to live in this despicable prison nation, this continent of prisons that we live in, of incarceration, the carceral state. We're going to get into some more discussion. First, a song. This is a cover. Since we started putting AWOL Radio on YouTube, some of the songs that we play have been tagged by record labels, and it forces ads. So I'm trying to play music that won't be tagged by record labels, so we can remain ad-free on AWOL Radio's YouTube stream. So, It Can't Be Just Me. This is a cover of Rebel Spell's It Can't Be Just Me. This one's by Jeff Andrew off of the Rebel Sing soundtrack, or Rebel Sing mix CD.
Just me. is me.
Jeff Andrew with cover of It Can't Be Just Me. Here on AWOL Radio. Going to go to some audio. This is Boots Riley with a shout out to the 2018 prison strike.
What's up? I'm Boots Riley, the writer and director of Sorry to Bother You. Check this out. There's a prisoner movement rising in this country. It's self-organized, independent, and fighting the dehumanization and brutality of the prison system. From August 21st, the anniversary of George Jackson's assassination, to September 9th, the anniversary of the Attica uprising, a coalition of prisoner networks have issued a set of 10 demands and called for work strikes, sit-ins, boycotts, hunger strikes inside all facilities across this country, state, federal, ICE, juvies, and county jails. So far, prisoner groups over 17 states have been confirmed to be participating. These 10 demands range from demanding the restitution of rehabilitation services that have been cut to almost nothing, restitution of Pell Grants so inmates can get educated, restoring the right to litigate their own cases, an end to abandonment and life sentences without parole, the right to vote, and an end to forced labor and prison slavery. Prisoners themselves are a rising force for liberation, and our outside support to raise their voices and to defend them from repression is crucial. Inside, outside, all on the same side. Support the nationwide prison strike.
Out itsgoingdown.org/prisonstrike. Donate to the, there's various links as well to the prison strike. That was Boots Riley giving a shout out to the 2018 prison strike. North-shore.info, Shane, an undercover cop in Hamilton. Submitted September 6, 2018. Submitted anonymously to North Shore Counter Info. He was here on and off for about 2 years, first appearing in the summer of 2016. His name is Shane. That's his undercover name and his real name. Shane Bond is what he told us, with us being the different communities and circles in Hamilton he tried to infiltrate. Shane was just another dude when he showed up. To be honest, most of us didn't take notice, at least not at first. There were no leading or intrusive questions. He didn't incite divisive arguments or spread gossip. He was quiet, maybe even boring. And while he did persistently harass women in our community to grab a beer despite rejection, it didn't scream cop so much as misogyny, an experience that's unfortunately still somewhat normal in our circles. To those who engaged or paid attention, Shane presented himself as a bicycle-riding part-time painter, complete with a shitty supercycle bike and painting pants. He had an apartment at 20 Emerald Street North, a Hamilton housing building for folks with low income, that was furnished with a leather couch, some photos, and some paintings. Shane had a girlfriend who worked at a private daycare, who no one met, and a muscular feminine presenting friend with below shoulder length brown hair from Dundas, who came to at least one event. Shane's arrival came after several years of dedicated anti-pipeline organizing and heightened anti-gentrification efforts. He was known to attend the Tower for events and socials, Hamilton 350 meetings, anti-pipeline events, and a handful of public demos, including an anti-racist rally and a solidarity demo at Barton Jail. Mostly, but not completely, Shane failed at his job. For all the time he spent here trying to build relationships and ins, he didn't get far. It took some time to connect with people who interacted with Shane, verify their stories, and write this text. But with some reflection, we know that Shane didn't have much more to offer his higher-ups than which any casual observer could. He wasn't successful in his intended infiltration. The only exception to that was that after having been around for 2 years, he was in the right place at the right time. Shane was shown a flyer for a demonstration against gentrification on Lock Street, which he attended, and he appears to be giving evidence against the people charged in connection with it. Ultimately, Shane was best at was avoiding cameras, or at least ours. We had a hard time finding a picture of him, but it turns out back in 2011, Rick Mercer hung out with Hamilton Police, and Shane, a then yellow-jacketed action cop, made a promo video with Mercer, where you can see him shortly after minute 212. Since embarrassing shit never really disappears from the internet, we grace you all with this rat goof face anyways. In his words, Shane's backstory. Shane told folks he was from Saskatoon and BC. He seemed to know a good amount about both places, including detailed climate and geography. He said he painted part-time and sometimes attended events right after work in painter's pants. His apartment was mostly furnished, had art on the walls, painted by his mom, and what we understood to be personal photographs. He said he enjoyed loose-leaf tea, but almost always had shitty steep tea with him. At one point, Shane went somewhere during his undercover operation here in Hamilton for approximately 6 months. Whether that was to actually be by his mom's side in BC as she died, as he explained, or to infiltrate another community, we don't know. But we strongly encourage those organizing around gentrification or pipelines to share his photo and any experiences they've had with him. What we do know is that Shane isn't the only undercover cop working throughout Turtle Island. If you're doing anti-pipeline organizing or other rad organizing, then expect and plan for the possibility of this kind of infiltration and surveillance too. We know it can be tempting to dismiss or rationalize otherwise, but this isn't just happening in the US or abroad. This isn't just happening in BC, and it's not just happening in the lead up to summits. The state is throwing their resources towards effective organizing against industry and the state, period. Flags. Shane's political analysis was lacking and never really evolved despite attending workshops and events. He'd often try to relay ideas or sentiments using common terms or slang, but out of context. The result was abrupt, unsettling interactions like a sudden proclamation of, "I'm so glad I found someone else who hates the pigs." He was also seen more than once hovering around an area or group of folks listening in on conversations, and when he returned from his trip to BC, Shane could recognize and recall people's names perfectly, whether they'd previously conversed much or not. Afternote. Recently, the Mining Injustice Solidarity Network, MISN, released a great reflection on their experiences and reflections with an undercover in Toronto. It talks a bit more in depth about how some indicators may not be enough to warrant expulsion from a community, but certainly a good enough reason to get to know someone more. Importantly, it also talks about ways we might be able to identify and confirm undercover. It's worth reading, and that's available at infiltration.fail. And again, that's Shane, an undercover cop in Hamilton, Ontario, posted up on north-shore.info. AWOL Radio here, Dan Keller in studio with you. And we are going to go to another piece from Prison Radio. This one is Mumia Abu-Jamal, and it's Capitalism and Slavery, an excerpt from Mumia's fantastic book, Murder, Inc., here on AWOL Radio.
Incorporated, Part 1, Empire, Genocide, Manifest Destiny, by Mumia Abu-Jamal and Stephen Vittori. Capitalism and Slavery. Between Columbus's arrival and the end of the U.S. Civil War, nearly 12 million slaves were viciously ripped from their homeland and transported to the Americas, with approximately 500,000 arriving in the U.S., leaving almost 11 million landing south of the U.S. border. The dead, and there were countless souls lost on these murderous voyages along the Middle Passage, were not counted, but rather tossed overboard. In fact, many Africans who suffered from disease or were driven insane by deplorable and shocking conditions were either thrown overboard alive or first clubbed to death and then thrown overboard. It is against this backdrop of a macabre and low-down slave trade, along with wanton murder, that the European powers in the British Empire fueled and maintained their vaunted industrial revolution, moving dramatically from mercantilism to the corporate god of capitalism. It is no wonder that Karl Marx writes in Capital of European capitalism rising out of the bloody womb of African slavery. Looking back over Marx's influential work as a philosopher, economist, and historian, it becomes clear that he identified the enslavement of Africans in America as an essential force behind mounting capitalism, not only in the New World, but in Europe as well. In the late 1840s, Marx wrote a prescient observation regarding American slavery as it relates to the American Empire's financial wherewithal. Direct slavery is just as much the pivot of bourgeois industry as machinery, credits, etc. Without slavery, you have no cotton. Without cotton, you have no modern industry. It is slavery that has given the colonies their value. It is the colonies that have created world trade. And it is world trade that is the precondition of large-scale industry. Thus, slavery is an economic category of the greatest importance, Marx writes. In 1944, Eric Williams' Capitalism and Slavery challenged the secure, mythical tenets of European and American history. Williams, who later became the Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago, makes a powerful case that the African slave trade propelled Europe's rise to global economic dominance, and that the massive profits from the triangular slave trade, Europe to Africa to the Americas and back again, helped to finance and bolster the Industrial Revolution. Williams contends that the occupation and subsequent takeover of the so-called New World was reliant upon the enslavement and exploitation of the African slaves held captive in the Americas. Williams examines this economic history by focusing on the British slave trade with the West Indies. The triangular trade thereby gave a triple stimulus to British industry. The profits obtained provided one of the main streams of that accumulation of capital in England, which financed the Industrial Revolution. Sir Josiah Child estimated that every Englishman in the West Indies, with the 10 blacks that worked with him, accounting what they ate, use, and wear, would make employment for 4 men in England. By Davenant's computation, one person in the islands, white or Negro, was as profitable as 7 in England. England was by far the dominant force in the triangular slave trade throughout the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. A powerful navy coupled with seemingly unlimited capital enabled the British to flourish when it came to human trafficking, although the French, Portuguese, Dutch, and Americans were vigorous competitors. Among many others, Karl Marx suggests that all capitalist societies in their formative years require the primitive accumulation of capital. The slave trade provided a motherlode of this necessary early wealth to help launch the French, Dutch, and British capitalist models.
AWOL Radio, that was Capitalism and Slavery, excerpt from Mumia Abu-Jamal's book, Murder Incorporated, and that was read by Mumia Abu-Jamal. And we're going to read one more article before we tap out for today, and that is going to be a new one from Dave Vasey, Why Environmental Justice Activists Should Fight Fascists. And it's on mediacoop.ca, posted September 6, 2018. Environmentalists can't ignore the menace of the far right. The climate crisis is growing. This year, the Arctic caught fire from drought and heat waves, and the next 4 years are predicted to be the hottest on record. Yet, the battle to save the planet has recently been complicated by global far-right movements, and the impact on the climate has been devastating. Trump quickly removed the U.S. from the Paris Agreement after being elected, and already governments are suggesting that this year's U.N. climate negotiations will fail. In Ontario, the newly elected Ford administration recently sent emails to ministries banning discussion of climate change. The far-right base mimics and influences far-right policies. Stormfront, the notorious white power website, contains an entire section on nature and environment. A thread on climate change proved to be one of the site's most popular, with over 97,000 views and 600-plus comments. Most posts were emotive attacks and complaints about people concerned about climate change, using gross language and with little evidence provided beyond YouTube videos. Yet, they are the base that supports Trump and Ford, and promotes Big Oil's climate denialism and false science. Unfortunately, conspiratorial narratives from the far right are often getting more popular attention than climate reports from NASA. On Turtle Island, also known as North America, far-right concepts of white supremacy promote the conquest and entitlement of European people to indigenous lands. Far-right groups have mobilized to disrupt events centering indigenous struggles in recent years in so-called Canada. In July 2017, members of the Canadian Armed Forces dressed as Proud Boys disrupted a ceremony led by community leader Grizzly Mama, who was protesting the Cornwallis statue in Halifax. Cornwallis infamously established the colony of Halifax with a bounty for the scalps of Mi'kmaq people. The Proud Boys openly promote Western chauvinism, or what is better described as capitalist colonial imperialism, the mentality threatening the survival of our species. In southern Ontario, the Indigenous community of Six Nations experienced several waves of white supremacist harassment during the reclamation of Gonestaten. A grassroots campaign in Six Nations stopped a housing development by the town of Caledonia on unceded lands. In 2011, a mobilization by neo-Nazis and anti-Native activists at the site of the reclamation called for armed struggle against Indigenous communities. Importantly, these races were met by counter-demo of hundreds of anti-racists who mobilized on buses throughout southern Ontario to oppose racists and support Six Nations land defense. Over the past 2 years, white supremacist street mobilizations in southern Ontario have targeted Muslim people with racist rhetoric and conspiracy theories. The idea that Muslim people pose a significant threat to rich nation states is insulting, particularly when espoused by white nationalists, whose nation has both profited from and contributed to the destabilization of the Middle East. Since the start of the 2003 invasion of Iraq, an estimated 2.4 million people have died from that war. The perpetual war on terror has relied on Islamophobia to normalize military operations by rich nations for oil. The U.S. has never admitted that the Iraq war was about oil during the invasion, though the U.S. secured oil fields first while bombing hospitals and schools. Many of the economic policies developed post-invasion Iraq enriched U.S. corporations and ensured America First plunders of oil resources. The war-torn areas in the Middle East have been hit severely by climate crisis. It has been widely argued that the Syrian civil war was at least partially triggered by severe drought related to climate change. Approximately 11 million people were displaced in Syria because of the conflict, and of those, 5.1 million became refugees. Globally, researchers predict that in the next 50 to 100 years, there could be up to 2 billion climate refugees. On the streets, mobilizations by the far right represent an important fulcrum for the environmental justice movement. The far right are the manifestation of colonialism, toxic masculinity, racism, and nihilistic capitalist consumption. Ensuring that borders remain open and keeping the oil in the soil requires not only challenging the rich, but also the base that supports them. Environmental justice activists have a unique responsibility to confront racism and colonialism. We understand that the social conditions of oppression mimic the destruction of our planet. Today, the Arctic burns while Nazis march openly. It's time to bring the green and black back to Toronto and across the land. And two far-right rallies are being held this weekend in Toronto, and counter-protests are being organized, including one on Saturday, September 8th, and another on Sunday, September 9th. Check out mediacoop.ca, Why Environmental Justice Activists Should Fight Fascists by Dave Acey. This is AWOL Radio.